In a world that can be challenging, and at times unpredictable, it's hard to find moments to focus on what you need. Join Stephanie James on The Spark as she guides you to use your inner flame to ignite your best life. As a best-selling author, psychotherapist, transformational life coach, and international show host, Stephanie is dedicated to helping you create a life that takes you, your goals, and your passions to the next level, so you can live a life that is fully lit up and fully alive. She believes that your life is meant to be a beautiful expression of the things that light you up, that by living your dreams, you give permission to others to do the same. Are you ready to feel alive and inspired to fuel your dreams and put a fire behind your desires? Let's ignite a spark in one another that will illuminate the world. The Spark, with your host, Stephanie James, starts now.
Welcome to The Spark. I'm your host, Stephanie James. I'm so excited tonight. I have with me Danny Goldberg. And I know you've heard of Danny Goldberg. Right now, he's the president and owner of Gold Village Entertainment. He's been in the music business. He's worked as a personal manager, record company president, public relations man, journalist since the late 1960s. And today he's joining us. We're going to be discussing his latest book, Bloody Crossroads. So excited to have you here, Danny. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks. Nice to hear and see you.
Thank you. So, you know, I know that you probably get the question all the time, you know, what inspired you to write this book? But it's obvious from your history in the entertainment world, this was such a natural fit. You know, in the beginning of the book, you talked about the influence that entertainers have had in politics, and this has been nothing new. You know, what do you think made entertainers' influence in this? You know, it's Bloody Crossroads 2020, forgive me, you know, and the importance of the entertainers' influence in this particular time, in this political arena.
Well, for the election of 2020, which is mostly what the book is about, although I try to create some context, like you mentioned, I think that the creative community certainly participated and was outspoken at a level that I don't think has ever happened before in an election. And the question often comes up, well, what difference did it make? Are they, and my feeling is, I don't think that somebody decides whether or not they like Donald Trump based on what Bruce Springsteen said or what Cardi B said or Taylor Swift or some movie or something on Netflix. But I do think among the people that didn't like Trump, the creative community and the popular culture in general created a sense of urgency and intensity that increased turnout. And I think that particularly among younger people, that sometimes artists' voices are easier to hear and take in than those of op-ed writers or the people who do commercials for candidates. So I think that they had a fair amount to do with the atmosphere, the intensity, and the level of engagement among voters and among those who did vote and who didn't like Trump. I think they helped influence the people that are sort of on the left, and especially young people, that it was better to vote for Biden than to vote third party, for example. In 2016, when Trump had his Electoral College victory, third party votes were 5.7% of the total amount, Green Party, Libertarian. And in 2020, that number was down to 1.7%. And I think that those four points, I think, mostly benefited Biden. I think it's arguable that differential made the difference in the swing states, where the margin was usually like 1 or 2%. So I think in terms of uniting the center and the left and increasing the amount of engagement, that they made a difference.
Well, and, you know, I was really resonating with this as I was reading it. You know, I think it was at one point in the book you quoted, I believe it was John Legend, maybe talking about how, you know, music and different, you know, entertainers, it's like they speak to our hearts. So there's like a different language that's spoken. And I feel like that is must be one of the most profound things in this, as you're stating, you know, because it's not just that they're convincing us. The way that they have impacted us is really at a heart level. So we're hearing the message differently.
I think that's right. I think artists, that is the language that they traffic in. And it's that part of kind of the mind that art and entertainment tends to address in a totally different way than a newspaper article or, a commercial or something like that. And I think that the idea of raising an election to the level of morality is different from arguing about what the tax rate should be. And that there was a sense that a lot of people had that this was not just about disagreements about, should there be Medicare for all, or should we keep the current system, or is there some other system? Or how much environmental regulation there should be, but that it had an existential feeling about, are you for democracy and inclusiveness or not? And that the artists were useful in framing it as sort of a moral decision that was not just a typical election. I think that they have that ability to do that. I was very impressed with John Legend's intelligence and his thoughtfulness. He told me that from the time he was a teenager, he wanted to be both an artist and a political activist. He'd written some essay for McDonald's to win some scholarship saying that, but as much as I was impressed with him and always inspired by Springsteen, who I was lucky enough to talk to for the book, and some other musical artists and some directors and actors, to me, the soundtrack of the Trump era was comedy. That I think that there was something about the nature of that presidency, the nature of the media, the difficulty that conventional news media had in covering Trump, that comedy ended up speaking the emotional language to a lot of people better than conventional political speech. And, you know, when Jon Stewart started hosting the Daily Show in 1999, he was the only late night host who combined comedy with politics, with ideology. The Trump era, it was every host every night. It was hard to find a Netflix special that didn't have 10 minutes about Trump. And I think that created an atmosphere culturally that redounded to the Democrats' benefit in that particular cycle. Again, not because it's going to change people's ideology, but it does change people's judgment about whether it's worth it to go and vote or not. And if you are going to vote, is it worth it to vote for a Democrat who you may not love, but who nonetheless is preferable than the other, as Biden calls him, the other guy, or the former guy.
Well, and I think it was so great because, I mean, Trump, in the way that he would fire back at people and the comedians and all the different things he would do, I mean, he gave them fresh material every week.
You know, he comes out of the entertainment world, and that's part of why I think so many people in the creative community felt almost this obligation or calling to weigh in. I don't think there's any chance Donald Trump could have been a plausible national candidate if he hadn't been the host for more than a decade of a primetime television show that was branding him as this business genius, you know, The Apprentice. And the people in show business know that reality television doesn't have that much to do with reality. It's those shows are scripted, they're edited, they're created to get ratings. And so if those kind of skills of storytelling and emotional interaction and quotable moments and riveting images, if that's what was going to drive the course of the federal government, I think a lot of people that hadn't previously been politically engaged, people like Robert De Niro or Taylor Swift didn't really get engaged until after Trump was president. People didn't even know what her politics were. There were Aryan Nation blogs that claimed her as one of their own as recently as 2015, I think, or 16. So I think that the fact that Trump came out of showbiz basically created a greater drama in the minds of a lot of the creative community. And somehow between that and the issues of race that have bedeviled this country since, colonies were first settled, and the issues of gender, which exploded during the Trump era with the Me Too movement, and the fact that he defeated the first woman that had a chance of being president, even though she got more votes, created a level of emotional engagement for the creative community, as I said, that was unprecedented.
Yeah, and I found it so interesting because I didn't know about Taylor Swift's Netflix special, Miss Americana. And that's kind of where she came out, if you will, about her political views. And she even, from what I read, that she had made an apology to her dad for, she had to stand on the right.
Yeah. What's that? Yeah, for possibly embarrassing her parents. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But that she had to stand on the right side of history.
Yeah, she had that special came out, I think it was in 2020, at the beginning of the year. She had first showed her political color, so to speak, in the midterms in 2018, because it was after that white supremacist blog claimed that she was one of their own. She's so blonde and she's from the South and all that stuff that she was so appalled by it. So she actually had endorsed the Democrat in the senatorial race in Tennessee in 2018, the former governor Bresden, who ran an unsuccessful campaign to unseat the Republican Marsha Blackburn. And once she, and I think that footage in Miss Americana was shot around the time that she was just about to announce, which side she was on. And the thing I liked about that special, look, I'm a rock and roller, I'm a baby boomer. Taylor Swift is not the music that spoke to me when I was growing up. I certainly respect her incredible talent at just amassing a vast audience and song after song. She's an incredibly gifted songwriter performer, but I'm not like part of a natural fan base, obviously, demographically, but I was very touched by her candor about the pressures on somebody coming into the pop country world to please people, to not make waves, to not make enemies, and that had been drilled into her head of how to be a success in show business, and she's obviously someone who intensely cares about what people think about her. You don't become that successful without wanting to be successful. And that it was a wrenching feeling to know that she was going to alienate some people who liked her music. But, I think she felt morally called to do it. I think I'm sure her friends and peer group influenced her too. But look, she had more Twitter followers than Trump did. After she endorsed the Democrat, Trump said, he was usually very vicious when he would attack creative people. He attacked John Legend and his so-called loudmouthed wife, and he said that Meryl Streep was overrated, and he badmouthed all the late night talk show hosts on a regular basis, wondering how they got their jobs and claiming that they got no ratings and so on. Taylor Swift, he gave this very mild rebuke, saying, well, I guess I like Taylor Swift's music about 25% less now. Which obviously he never listened to Taylor Swift's music. Why would he? He's older than me. But I think it was his grudging respect for the fact that she had a few million more Twitter followers than he did. And he liked to, like a lot of bullies, he prefers to beat up people that are not his so easy to fight back, And he walked on eggshells with her. Even Trump did. So, you know, another person I thought really emerged as an interesting voice from kind of the young pop world was Cardi B, who an ardent Bernie Sanders supporter, had done this YouTube video with Sanders that I think 14 million people watched during the primaries, more, a greater number than who watched any of the Democratic debates. But after Sanders dropped out, she did a video with him asking him to explain why he was endorsing Biden. And then she did a YouTube thing with Biden, where, as she said, introducing him to her platform. And I got to believe that helped some reluctant Bernie supporters feel okay. Reluctant about Biden, people who had supported Bernie, because Bernie support is very passionate. Many of my friends are in that group, made them feel kind of a moral permission to vote for Biden and a sense of urgency about what was at stake. So, it's, again, part of the mix. I don't want to exaggerate it. Obviously, the campaigns themselves mattered more. COVID mattered more. George Floyd. I mean, there's these giant forces happened in 2020. But I do think the creative community was part of the mix.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're going to talk about this even more when we come back, because I do want to dive in a little bit talking about COVID-19 and the Black Lives Matter and Me Too movement. And of course, the influence that entertainers and creatives have had in those areas over these years. So join us after this break, where we're going to be talking again with Danny Goldberg. Stay tuned.
TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Welcome back to The Spark. I'm your host, Stephanie James. So glad to have you with us here in the new year. It has just been such an exciting year to start plugging into new ideas, new ways of moving forward, and new ways of envisioning our lives. And I'm so thrilled today to have Danny Goldberg with us. And we're talking about his amazing book, Bloody Crossroads 2020. And Danny, I don't have the secondary title. Will you share that with us?
Yes, it's Art, Entertainment, and Resistance to Trump.
Yes, thank you. That's the essential piece. And it's like the one piece I didn't write down.
I admit right away in the book, this is not an unbiased account. I was not for Trump. I'm a lifelong kind of lefty Democrat. But, I tried to be intellectually honest and, you know, about who the people in the community were who did support Trump and to try to. But it's a tale of a community's role in a campaign that I supported.
Yeah. Yeah. And what was the passion behind this? I mean, this feels like a passion project. What was that for you?
Oh, for me, well, I grew up, I've been attracted for my career. I've been in the music business since I was 18. I certainly represented artists over the years or worked with them who I never talked to about politics and some of whom had different views than I did. I've definitely worked with artists who were publicly Republicans. I have no problem separating art from politics, but I've also had a long history of working with people in the creative community who did want to weigh in on political issues. I think that phenomenon goes back at least as far as Charlie Chaplin in the 40s when he did The Great Dictator, the anti-Hitler movie that at the time was controversial even in the U.S. because the U.S. hadn't gotten into the war yet. And grew up at a time during the Vietnam War when people like Jane Fonda and Country Joe and the Fish and others were Phil Oakes and others were weighing in on the war. And then when I got into the business, I found myself attracted to artists like Bonnie Raitt, who shared a lot of the political views I had and worked a lot with the American Civil Liberties Union in Southern California, which had a long history of including artists in the way they dealt with civil liberties there. In fact, Burt Lancaster, the great actor, was one of my predecessors as the ACLU chair of Southern California and remained engaged until the day he died. So I was fascinated by the role that artists could play because I've always had this nagging frustration the way a lot of people on the Democratic side have about, like, why aren't we doing better? You know, why aren't we, why does our country not have health care for everybody when every other Western country does? Why is our country saddle people with six-figure college debt when no other country does that? Why is, you know, and there are just certain basic things about being in a modern civilization that for political reasons, you know, people in the U.S. don't have, even though there are a lot of things we have that are wonderful. I mean, I've lived here my whole life. I'm very proud of the culture of the country, you know, rock and roll, Hollywood, jazz, blues. I look at the accomplishments of the tech sector and the general notion of democracy, which, even though it hasn't always been actualized here, maybe one would say never has actually been actualized here, is at least an aspiration that was given voice by the founding of the U.S. and has gone more in the right direction than not in my lifetime. So but nonetheless, there's a frustration that, you know, that some of the dreams of the Great Society, of the New Deal, of how a modern society should be organized and give some security and opportunity for everyone while still maintaining enough, capitalism for a society to flourish and function and reward the most successful people. You know, that it's just something. It always that nagging feeling that Democrats and liberals and so on just weren't communicating as well as the other side, that the right wing used people from the advertising world in a more effective way. They had a guy like Reagan who came out of Hollywood, as Trump did, to articulate a philosophy that Barry Goldwater failed with, but Reagan was the better salesman of. That artists could play a role in getting away from the legalistic, wonky, deadening, boring political language that turned a lot of people off. So I was always fascinated by that. I was grateful when I could participate in certain issues with certain creative people. And then when Trump happened, I was just blown away by the increase and the widening of the involvement of the community, that it felt like a television show every day. He had that performer's flair for getting attention. And who was going to compete with that in the populist pop world? The majority of Americans who don't read the op-eds or listen to public radio or frankly listen to podcasts like this. And it seemed to me that that the comedians and the artists were making a contribution that I just wanted to document. And then, you know, and then lockdown happened, that I had a lot of time on my hands, so it was the great time to research and write the book.
Perfect. Yes. Well, and that's a perfect segue to speaking about, you know, some of the issues that happened during Trump's administration, which, you know, with COVID, the Me Too movement and Black Lives Matter. Yeah. Can you talk about just how those issues even more so heightened some of these entertainers and creatives' voices?
Yeah. I guess those were the three gigantic issues that enveloped a lot of the country during the Trump era. I think the one that ends up being the most lasting significance is the Black Lives Matter movement, because the role of race in America, it's been, I mean, you know, Condi Rice, who's not a public figure I'm a great fan of, George W. Bush's former Secretary of State, said that America, one thing she said I agreed with, she said America has a birth defect, and that was the birth of a nation that included slavery, and that the despite the wishes of a lot of people that we just forget about that and act like it had no connection with the modern world, it's not borne out by reality when you look at the disparity of income, of wealth, of how people are treated in the criminal justice system, the ability to get to housing loans, job applications, and so on. And You know, it's hard to ignore the juxtaposition of the first African-American president, Barack Obama, with the most blatantly racist president of the last 100 years anyway, in Trump. And to have the murder of George Floyd happen in the middle of that 2020 campaign and captured in such a gruesome detail on a video I think spoke to so many of the issues that have been at the center of American politics for my whole lifetime. You know, I recently, like a few days ago, I rewatched Ava DuVernay's movie Selma about the campaign that Dr. King and John Lewis and others had for voting rights in Alabama I think that was 65, and it's 57 years ago, and boy, it's shocking how many of the arguments are the same as one heard on the floor of the U.S. Senate a couple of days ago, that this is such a long-term issue for the society. And I think it affects societies in other parts of the world, but we have the unique phenomenon in the U.S. of the way African-Americans were treated here. The central question is policy revolve around tribalism and me and my group versus everybody else, or is it involved around the idea of community and finding ways for disparate groups with different beliefs to respect and take care of each other? And so I think that had a huge, huge impact. And I certainly the creative community reacted intensely to it. First of all, show business, Hollywood, the music business, and others have their own mixed record of when it comes to matters of race. It was only, I think when I was in the record business, I was made president of Atlantic in the early 90s, Atlantic Records, and Sylvia Rhone was made president of Elektra. And I think she was only the second African-American ever made president of a record company, Ed Eckstein having been the first a couple of years earlier. And my goodness, popular music in America is so driven by Black music. I mean, rock and roll, jazz, blues, it all emanated from the Black culture. And as late as the 80s, there had been no African-Americans in positions of authority. I think that the whole movie industry, the showrunners, I document how the meetings that were had among the people who produce and write television shows to try to really look inward and look at the racism within the creative community at the same time that they were trying to champion for the rights of African Americans, not to be treated differently by police forces and to the justice system. So I think that was just, I'd have to put that at number one. The Me Too movement also addressed issues that were not new. And that there's a TV show that I love. I think the best political art of the last few years has been this TV series called The Good Fight, which was a spinoff of the show The Good Wife. And it's I think there's going to be another season of it. CBS produces it. And it's about this law firm in Chicago, and that's a predominantly Black firm with some white lawyers, and they address a wide array of issues through the drama of the characters of the show. And in the season's premiere of the season that was shown during 2020. The protagonist, one of the protagonists, Diane Lockhart, who's played by Christine Baranski, has a dream. And it's a dream sequence that takes up 2/3 of the episode in which Hillary Clinton had actually won the election, not Trump. And in that alternative reality, the Me Too movement never happened, and Harvey Weinstein was still the dominant mogul. And I think what they were getting at is the part of the rage about misogyny in the workplace and elsewhere that happened during the Trump years was connected to the pain of the first female that could have been president being defeated by, you know, a gleeful misogynist, you know, and that certainly certainly motivated, I think, a significant part of the creative community to become vocal very early in the Trump presidency. That comment where Trump said Meryl Streep was overrated, the 3-time Oscar winner, you know, was certainly one of the greatest actors of her generation. And then COVID obviously is a once in a century phenomenon. It just totally changed the whole architecture of the society. We're still dealing with it as we speak. But before the vaccine, the lockdown went on for months and months for many of us. I knew people who died from that version of COVID. I don't know anyone who's died from Omicron. I think a lot of that has to do with the vaccine. So there was no vaccine for, you know, during the entire 2020 campaign. There was the promise of one, but it hadn't become available yet. And, you know, it affected certainly so many more people were looking at screens. You know, the Netflix numbers went way up. The Spotify numbers went way up. And engagement and social media went way up because people, a disproportionate number of people were at home that otherwise would be at work. And so conversations through the media took on a bigger part of the political drama of the year. And it also touched at basic issues of morality about what is a government supposed to do? Are we just looking out for our own tribe or for the country as a whole? Is it worth sacrificing a million people for the economy to be better? These were the underlying cosmic arguments that went to the root of libertarianism versus liberalism and many, many other things that COVID shone a bright light on. So when I started writing the book, none of these things had happened yet. Harvey Weinstein hadn't been arrested yet. And certainly George Floyd hadn't been murdered and COVID hadn't happened, but boy, so it was quite a ride. I mean, that's not exactly right. The Harvey Weinstein thing did happen. That happened early in Trump's presidency. The other two happened in 2020, though. So, yeah, what to say? Those things are still front and center in a lot of the political conversations. Obviously, as we speak, the voting rights has been debated, and two Democrats decided they didn't want to change the filibuster rule. So, therefore, allowing what many of us feel are racist voter suppression to happen in some of the very states that the original Voting Rights Act, the old Confederacy, you know, no mystery about where these states are and what the political history of them is. So it's still with us, no question about that. It's a quite a complicated conversation the world is having about whether or not democracy is the right thing for their family and tribe or for the society as a whole. And boy, there are a lot of things I don't like about the Democratic Party or about the American system, but the alternative of authoritarianism is definitely worse.
Absolutely. And, you know, and what I find fascinating too, Danny, is as you were talking about Black Lives Matter and really the history of the neglect of that, and then also with the Me Too movement, I thought what was interesting is during the Trump administration, those things were always with us, and yet it was like all of a sudden the light was brightly shone upon these issues, and all of a sudden maybe what was underneath the surface, I think of it as like this hemorrhaging wound that just had this bandage on top of it, and all of a sudden it couldn't hold anymore. And so what was revealed was the infection that was there, that had been there for so long. And so it instead became then the public conversation. It came into the public arena, and it was important that people could, you know, go to the protest for Black Lives Matter. People could have a voice that didn't have a voice. People could, you know, stand up and feel confident. Some for the first time saying, "Me too."
Yeah. And then there was the line drawn between those feelings and what people do at election time, because elections are boring. First of all, waiting online is boring. You know, the whole process is annoying. The candidates, even the candidates I support, are usually opaque, and they use a lot of phony language to so that you don't really know what they're going to do. To motivate people to overcome the understandable resistance to that process, to actually pull a lever, is a huge part of the difference of who ends up controlling the government, you know. And it, turnout. There's no question, if you poll Americans on issues of universal health care, background checks for guns, forgiveness of college debt, you know, the whole shopping list of so-called liberal issues, you know, 60%+ are on the so-called progressive side. But translating that into political reality in a system where, you know, Montana gets the same number of senators as California or New York, or where there's this electoral college formulation from the 18th century that decides who's president, regardless, even when the popular vote goes the other way. And when that's happened twice in the last couple of decades, you know, two of the last three presidents, you know, before Biden were elected with getting less votes. That to translate the actual majority will for progress, and especially the will of younger people who have the most at stake based on what politicians decide, into political reality is very difficult. It takes an enormous amount of intensity and keeping your natural allies awake and engaged through the tedious weeks of disappointment and half measures that the system produces. And it's not an easy journey for anybody involved, but I do think that the more people, the greater quantity of people that are engaged, the better the outcome is. And I like being on the side of more inclusiveness rather than more restriction. I think that's, and I especially like being on the side of younger people, because I do think they're smarter than us.
Well, and they definitely are more educated and more aware than I know that I grew up.
They're way more progressive politically. I mean, you know, even in 2016, somebody did a map of what would have happened in the election if only people under 30 had voted. And I think Hillary Clinton would have gotten like 140 states or something, you know. And of course, if only people under 30 had voted, she wouldn't have gotten the nomination. Bernie Sanders would have. So I just think that matters morally. I mean, someone who's 20 has way more time. And then my kids, you know, who are in there, well, my daughter's now in her early 30s, my son is in his late 20s. They're not kids anymore, but they're still, they have way a much bigger percentage of their life ahead of them than I do. I think people under 30 should each get two votes, because the elections affect them at least twice as much as they affect everyone else. I don't think that's going to be high on the list of initiatives that the Congress makes, but I really believe morally that they have more at stake.
I love that. I love that, because the decisions we're making, as you know, and I think about my own daughters too, and I have two young grandsons, you know, it's that generation and the next and the next. I mean, we're voting for the next few generations here.
Why should we get to tell them? Like, we won't even be here, and they're going to have to live with these, you know, what Kyrsten Sinema thinks about the filibuster, you know, I mean, and which affects dealing with global warming, and it affects so many other things anyway, that's not a practical suggestion, but I do think it's a moral reminder about we really should do what's best for younger people. I think societies that take their leadership and think that way are more enlightened and moral than ones that are just trying to protect privilege of those of us who already have most of what we need in the material world.
Yeah. Yes. I love that. Well, and more of this conversation to come. We have one more break. And when we're back, we're going to continue our conversation with Danny Goldberg, discussing his book, Bloody Crossroads 2020, and so much more. Join us after this break.
Get empowered on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Welcome back to The Spark. I'm your host, Stephanie James. I'm here with Danny Goldberg. And for those of you who are just joining us, he's the president and owner of Gold Village Entertainment. And as he's worked in the music business as a personal manager, record company president, public relations man, and journalist since the 1960s, author of several books. And today we've been discussing his latest book, Bloody Crossroads 2020. And so, you know, you mentioned earlier, Danny, about your conversation with Bruce Springsteen. And I just found that fascinating. You know, you were talking about with older rock and roll fans, you know, no one has more celebrity than Bruce. And so, you know, he really was on the public forum talking about COVID, Black Lives Matter, all these other things. You know, what did you learn from him about, and I guess, and what do you know about, how did he influence and educate the public on these really important issues? And how did he affect, do you think, some of these things with the 2020 election?
Well, one of the things about art and entertainment is it's not politics where there's only two choices. There's hundreds of choices. And so people break up into smaller tribal groups of based on who they're excited about. Opera fans love opera. Country music fans love country music. Bluegrass aficionados only listen to bluegrass, some of them. Rock and rollers believe that's the only good music that ever existed. Was, you know, a lot of people in my generation actually believe that. And of course, hip hop fans, that's the only thing they listen to. So you're dealing with smaller groups of people, but who are tribal in their own way. And the question is, does an artist they admire influence them politically? I definitely do not think that they're going to change someone's mind about, you know, how they feel about socialism versus capitalism, or even how they feel about Republicans, or, you know, whether they support Republicans or not, how they feel about police reform or a lot of things like that. But I do think that they can take an issue and raise its salience. I think of the way Jimmy Kimmel talked about the health care bill at a certain point when Trump was trying to overturn it. I think his passion, because his young son had just had an operation that most people couldn't afford without Obamacare, 99% of people couldn't afford, added a level of intensity. So again, I think the role of artists during an election is not to get people to change their mind about who they like, but to persuade reluctant voters, people that are either turned off by politics in general, or just don't see enough difference between the two major parties to think it's worth making a choice. And I think for Springsteen has among the most passionate fans. If you ever go to a show, I mean, people are just weeping and cheering and dancing around. And as he said to me, he knows a lot of his fans voted for Trump. He said some of his family members voted for Trump. It's not that he was going to change their minds. But I think in terms of the people that didn't like Trump, you know, and I'm repeating myself a little bit, but it applies. He said this too. I think it raises their sense of urgency. And I think what Springsteen has been able to do for his whole career is bring a moral conversation about the idea of community to people. And in a sense, he's very conservative in terms of evoking verities about the way people in a community should take care of each other, respect each other, and look after each other's families, and how he felt that set of values applied to the electoral choices. You know, he also, from the beginning of his career, had a sensitivity to race, always had an African-American, Black member of his band, first Clarence Clemons, for the most famous part of his career. And had written over the years songs when there was somebody killed by police violence a couple of decades ago. I'm spacing out on the name now. And he wrote this song, I think 51 Shots, And so he periodically had weighed in. I was lucky enough to get to know him the first time he became political, which was at the end of 1979. I co-produced and co-directed a movie called No Nukes about artists that were opposing nuclear power as the energy alternative, an argument, by the way, that's still going on, even though it's been a pretty successful movement. And, you know, he was 30. He turned 30 the night of one of the shows and talked about the fact that he had been pretty famous for 5 or 6 years. He'd already released Born to Run and Darkness and On the Edge of Town, and was in the middle of recording the album that was later released called The River, and did the song The River at the No Nuke shows where he debuted it. And that he just felt that with the idea of turning 30 and having accomplished some of his initial career goals, that was part of adulthood, was to also weigh in on what was sort of good for the community and the society. And after that, from 1979 on, you know, he always had some cause that he was connecting his art to. He wasn't, as he said to me, he says, "I'm not an activist. I'm just a concerned citizen." He wasn't what we used to call the usual suspects, the people who showed up for every benefit, for every cause, who were always on a soapbox. His primary art has to do with individual issues about romance, depression, aspiration, frustration, and community. But he did, starting in 2004, was the first time he actually endorsed somebody running, when he endorsed John Kerry versus George W. Bush, because he had been so turned off by the Iraq war. And he from time to time, as he's say, takes, so I take my shot and use what cred I have. I have to do it carefully, you know. But the Trump thing got to him with the level of intensity that it got to so many others, whether it's Robert De Niro or Taylor Swift or Cardi B or some of the showrunners of TV shows or Steven Spielberg. And he was incredibly outspoken during the entire cycle. And the Biden people, to their credit, really embraced and included a lot of creative voices in their campaign. Bruce narrated one of the final Biden commercials. He sang at the inauguration. He sang, they played a song of his at the convention. And when the pandemic kicked in March of 2020, and he knew he couldn't tour, you know, like everyone else in the music business, like his tours were canceled, he started a radio show on the Sirius XM and, you know, talked about politics a lot. And after George Floyd did two entire shows just about race relations in the U.S. and became really one of the important moral thought leaders, I think, for the older white rock part of the population. You know, again, it's not entertainment, a lot more divisions than there are politically, but his is a nice chunk of it. And he's extremely articulate dude. So when he puts his mind to it, he can explain his views very persuasively. Again, I don't think he could take a Trump person. Look, Chris Christie, openly a gigantic Springsteen fan and openly voted for Trump twice. It's not like you can't like Bruce Springsteen and vote for Trump. That's not the vibe of Bruce or the reality of music fans. But in terms of creating a set of values that affects a lot of people and frames how they make those choices, I think he's a heavyweight. You know, there's no getting around it. And for his demographic audience, he's the heavyweight.
Well, and I think the thing that you said too that's so poignant is this piece of, yes, it's not going to change someone from a Trumper to, you know, going for Biden. And yet it's those people that are kind of the fence sitters or the people that are just
by elections.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the essential piece that it sounds like that's who he can really influence and make a difference on. And the people that are just like, I don't really want to go out today. I don't want to stand in that line. I don't want to have to do that. And through his passion and speaking of the importance of those issues, maybe it ignites something.
I think it helped. I think Cardi B helped with her fans. I think John Legend did. I think, you know, the comedians did. I think it was hundreds of people just felt, you know what? I want to weigh in. I don't know what's going to happen, but I do not want to be silent during this time. I think that's a healthy thing. And I also think in terms of framing issues, there's this deadening language that political consultants use based on focus groups or habit, and that political candidates use. They sound like politicians. And that melody, that particular language is just a turnoff to many people. It's a turnoff to me a lot of the time. So even the same idea sometimes expressed through comedy or through a drama can get through the barriers that a lot of us put up to politics, which often seems like lawyers and like just people trying to win an argument without a moral basis for it.
Exactly. And you know, that's one of the things we were talking about during the break, you know, and I can speak personally to that, that I wasn't as involved in politics, but it's like when you hear and you get that moral message behind it, you couldn't help but be persuaded to like, I've got to speak up. I've got to be involved. And it was greatly due to what we were seeing on television.
Yeah, and I'll tell you something, you know, there's been a lot of talk lately. You know, as we're speaking now at the end of January, about Biden's first year has just ended and he's less popular today than he was 8 months ago. And are they going to lose the midterms? And is Trump going to become Speaker of the House or a Trumpist, or is Trump going to run again and be president again? And what will happen to everything that a lot of us care about? And why is there so much? Why have the polls changed? I mean, part of it is a sort of an infantile desire for whoever's president to magically make everything better, make COVID go away. Another is, though, that there hasn't been that chorus of people in popular culture reiterating. It's a lot easier to be against something than to be for something. Being anti-Trump was like a bumper sticker. Being in favor of Biden, you've got to say, well, I know I disagree with him about this, this, and this, and I wish he had done this differently, but, you know, I'm glad we're getting infrastructure, or I'm glad that, we actually are, talking to other countries about climate change or something like that. So I'm hoping as we go into the midterms that the old band can get back together again, because I think it takes the whole band. It takes politicians, political advisors, journalists, academics, and the creative community to really reach enough people to create enough motivation to compete with a very well-funded, well-organized minority of right-wingers.
Well, and you've actually just gone to, my final question for you was really around this. Like, what are these most important issues for the entertainment industry to address in these months ahead?
I think there's the micro and the macro. I mean, among individual issues, and I'm a big believer, look, I started in the music business as a PR guy. And one thing you learn as a publicist is one message. One message, focus. Multiple messages cancel each other out, even if they're all virtuous. So I think on a micro issue, boy, I keep coming back to this thing about the price of prescription drugs, just having a son who's a type 1 diabetic and the idea that insulin costs 10 times as much in the US than it does in Canada only because of political machinations and corruption, and that everything from hearing aids to, that kind of a thing. I think prescription drugs is something that affects people, whether they're a right wing or a left wing, or whether religious or atheist, old or young, live in a red state or a blue state, a small town or a big city. Everybody at one point or another has to go to a drugstore or a pharmacy. And the idea that Americans pay more for the very same drugs as people in Canada, which is just separated by a man-made border, but it's essentially part of the same contiguous capitalist, Western society, is so crazy that I think that's a micro issue that I would focus on, even though there are 15 other important issues. But I think the macro issue is this whole idea of democracy. And I think that people have to really think about it. And I think artists can play a role in bringing to board. What does it mean to understand that if most people disagree with you, that they get to decide? Are you willing to lose elections? Are you willing to lose votes in order to protect the idea that the majority rules? And I was brought up believing that, and we use this word democracy as we always say we're protecting democracy, we're for democracy. But there is no question that there are a lot of people in the society, in particular in the Republican Party right now, who don't believe in democracy, who want a lower turnout, who don't want people in poor neighborhoods or students to be able to vote. They're open about it. They've said, look, we can't win if all those people vote. There are people that are questioning, maybe it would be better if we just had a dictator who could just tell everybody what to do and not have to go through 6 months of unpleasant congressional arguments and compromises. And unfortunately, we know what happens to societies that have dictators. It's horrible. And it's horrible for a lot of the people that support them. Believe me, a lot of people who originally supported Hitler didn't feel so great about him a few years later, but they were stuck. So I think that the whole notion of democracy has to be reopened and re-embraced, not just as a word, but what does it really mean to have majority rule? How do you deal with losing? Where is there moments where you create consensus and where there are moments where 51% gets to tell the other 49%, you know, that we, you know, can't have loud lawnmowers because it's, you know, or whatever it is, you know. And I think that it's sort of taken for granted, but it needs to be really examined and brought to life what that choice is. Because I think if you're for democracy in 2022, you're going to be for the Democrats. But I think people have to really get beyond the word into the meaning of it. And I think that's where the creative community can help. And then I finally think that just raising again what the existential choice is. Joe Biden was not my first, second, or third choice for the Democratic nomination in 2020. I was for Elizabeth Warren, and if it weren't her, I would have been for Bernie, or I like Jay Inslee a lot. I mean, I went down quite a list before I got to Biden. But one of the things I love that he said is, he said, don't compare me to the Almighty, compare me to the alternative. And I think that that's the same situation. Elections are not about making a personal statement for the voters. They're about making a choice. And I think that to create the moral context of the choice in 2022, so it doesn't just feel like another typical political campaign, is a job that the creative community could really help do.
Absolutely. And I love a term that you used earlier when you were talking about, you know, tribalism, and that it extends out further than just us, you know, or if we're, you know, Democrats or Republicans, that we have to look at these moral issues and the more existential issues.
Well, there's also tribalism within the tribes. And like, say, within my tribe, the roughly speaking, the Democratic coalition, there's a bitter dislike between so-called progressives and so-called moderates. I'm on the progressive side, but I have moderate friends, and I feel that it's important to find a way of recreating the coalition that I do give Biden credit for creating in 2020, where you could be a Bernie Sanders supporter and feel good about voting for Joe Biden in 2020 because Bernie created, and people like Cardi B and Susan Sarandon and John Cusack and a lot of other Bernie people created the space psychologically for that. And now we've had a lot of bitter arguments among Democrats, and I know which side of those arguments I'm on, but there has to be a finding a way within our own community of honoring each other's humanity, respecting those differences to deal with the greater threat, which is totalitarian authoritarianism, in which white nationalists and Klan members are part of the opposing coalition. I mean, there has to be a way of reforming that sense of connectivity that we had in 2020. And I think a lot of that is up to the people running for office, but a lot of that is up to other people who have audiences to say, we're going to keep disagreeing about these things, but we can agree that we don't want Trumpism, and then go back to arguing. So, you know, that's a complicated argument. And I know a lot of people that are very demoralized right now because of the things that haven't happened. I'm demoralized, but I also recognize that some good things have happened, and it would be a lot. We'd be feeling a lot worse right now if we were a year into Trump's second term. And who wins the midterms? It's a big deal. To a Speaker of the House is a big deal. There's also, if Democrats could get more popular in general, and I think Biden and the people around him are going to make a good effort, there's a really good chance of getting a bigger majority in the Senate instead of losing the Senate. And again, if collect two more Democrats, then Sinema and Manchin can't block what we want.
So this upcoming election, midterms being more important than ever.
Yeah, and it's so boring. I hate getting these fundraising emails. I hate somehow they got my cell phone and I get these calls and these texts. I hate that the language of every fundraising letter for the last 50 years must have been written by the same robot. They act like we're morons. I don't like the weird legalistic language that most of the people I vote for use when I see them on TV. I don't like some of the compromises they're willing to make. I don't like the influence of money on politics. But all those things are subordinate to preventing fascism.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting. It's like, how do we move to a human tribe?
Yeah.
You know, that becomes the most essential piece than the divisiveness that will bring us into that kind of regime, if you will.
It's and the funny thing is, it has something to do with the scale of things, because, you know, my wife's brother is mayor of a small town in northern Connecticut that voted 2/3 for Trump. You know, even though Connecticut is a blue state, rural sections of it, like other rural parts of America, are mostly Trump. And he's a lefty, old hippie like me. But because it's a town of 1,000 people and he knows personally most of the people, they know they don't agree with him about a lot of things, but they trust him as a human being to get the bridge fixed or to figure out what kind of new fire truck to get. And he was just reelected, you know, and, you know, and I think that it is so challenging to create, to find this shared humanity because of the power of the tribal messaging and how people derive their identity from it. But any models of shared humanity are good, and you see it in a disaster. You see it the way people take care of each other after a flood or a fire. They don't ask who did you vote for, you know. And you look at the great religions; they all have some similar ethical values. And atheists and agnostics have ethical values mostly that are similar to those of the great religions. You know, there are places of connection. And that's what we should aspire for, I think, as spiritual beings, is to see the humanity and the divinity in everybody, but at the same time, to be willing to take a stand ethically, according to our own values. And there's ways of doing that without dehumanizing the people you disagree with, but still being firm and unwavering on core values. So, hard, easy to say, hard to do. I'm glad we have a Dr. King holiday, because to me, he's the master of the modern Western world. You know, I go back, I keep rereading Taylor Branch's trilogy of the life of Dr. King, and go on YouTube and look at his speeches sometimes. I mean, he's a secular and Christian saint, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and Danny, I could keep talking to you because this is so fascinating. There's so much here. And unfortunately, we are out of time. I appreciate, and I know the listeners will absolutely resonate with this conversation. Are there any parting words or any essential message that you want to make sure is shared?
Well, Stephanie, first of all, thank you very, very much for having me on. And I just think don't give up. Don't give up. It's a marathon. People in past times have had much harder playing fields than the one we have. Hang in there one step at a time. Do your best. Be a good person and appreciate your life. That's all I can say.
That's it. That's beautiful. Thank you, Danny. Thank you so much for being a part of The Spark.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The Spark with Stephanie James. Remember that you already have what you need to live a life that is fully lit and fully alive. You're already holding the flame. Now it's time to ignite your best life. Learn more at stephaniejames.world. That's stephaniejames.world. And tune in next week at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, only on transformationtalkradio.com. Shine on!
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.